From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on May 8th, 2014 in Montpelier, Vermont. Governor Peter Shumlin signed a bill that day that would make Vermont the first state to require the labeling of genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. So far, studies have shown bioengineered food doesn't pose a documented health risk to consumers, but Vermont's legislature voted overwhelmingly for mandatory GMO labeling. Governor Shumlin said, quote, "Vermonters take our food and how it is produced seriously, and we believe we have a right to know what's in the food we buy," end quote. Several other states have passed similar laws that would require mandatory GMO labeling, but each of those states has a trigger provision. In other words, the law doesn't take effect until other states do the same, but not Vermont. And so on July 1st, Vermont's law will take effect. New York State has been considering mandatory GMO labeling, too. The food industry has largely pushed back, saying that it would be expensive and burdensome to have to create individual labels for individual states. How expensive? It's hard to say, and there is a gap in how the public views GMOs versus how the scientific community views GMOs. The Pew Research Center polled scientists connected to the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and in fact, Pew found that more scientists believe that GMOs are safe to eat than that human activity is affecting the Earth's climate. But only 37% of American adults agree, and 72% of U.S. consumers say they don't want to eat food that contains genetically modified organisms, or GMOs, according to a 2014 survey published in Consumer Reports. Most surveys find majority of Americans want mandatory labeling laws. Trader Joe's and Chipotle have chosen to go GMO-free. Well, this hour, a conversation about what the labeling laws might mean and a broader discussion about what we know or don't know about GMOs. My guests include in studio Matt Kelly, writer and photographer for Boomtown Table and author of a recent four-part series that looks at GMOs and potential labeling laws here. Matt, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
Jane Andrews is here. She's a nutrition and product labeling manager for Wegmans. Jane, nice to have you back.
Good.
And Anthony Shelton is on the line with us. He's a professor of entomology and associate director of international programs at Cornell University. Anthony, thanks for taking the time.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You know, I want to let our listeners know here, I'm somebody who just comes down on the side of evidence. This is not my expertise at all. I didn't grow up in agriculture. I don't know the science of this. I try to defer to scientific kind of consensus and expertise, and I'm going to do my best to kind of sort through your questions. We already have a lot of questions from our listeners, so we'll take your phone calls, but I want to work through a lot of what we already have that's come in with a series of questions. So, Matt, let me start with you.
Yeah.
Read your series in Boomtown.
Good.
And you're boomtowntable.com, and you wanted to focus on what New York State is currently considering. So tell us what's currently on the table for the state.
So currently on the table for the state is a bill. It's the second time around. It's the idea that foods that are produced with genetic engineering, whether partially or wholly, should be labeled so that consumers can make educated decisions about what they're purchasing and feeding their families.
Okay. And similar to what Vermont is doing, yes?
Yeah, in language and in process, yes.
Okay. And Jane Andrews, from Wegmans' perspective, from the grocery store perspective, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about, well, this is going to be burdensome, it's going to be expensive. Matt explored that, and we're going to get to that in a second from what he has been able to find. But from Wegmans' perspective, are you concerned that individual states doing this would be burdensome, would be expensive for consumers?
I believe it would be tremendously confusing for consumers. And I understand how, you know, Wegmans doesn't have stores in Vermont. We don't, that law is not going to affect us. But we do have stores besides New York State in five other states. So if we started to see different laws in different states, we would have a difficult problem. It's already difficult trying to sort out between credentialing programs like the non-GMO program, which is very different from Vermont and New York. So, or the European Union has different standards. So it's that trying to figure out what's best for our consumers and what they're looking for is kind of what we're trying to figure out.
Okay. Has Wegmans taken a position on whether New York State should pass a law like this?
Not specifically. We have asked for a national standard.
Okay, so you want to see a national standard,
yes.
which, by the way, a national standard was considered. Congress, various members of Congress have tried to essentially do that, and that would be a way to kind of circumvent state laws. So some people, I think, Jane, are you know, the Vermonters and the pro-GMO labeling side says a national standard is just a way to stop GMO labeling.
I think a national standard, depending on what it is, I mean, maybe it'll end up being a mandatory standard. I think FDA does not have without congressional intervention, FDA cannot step in and create a national standard because there's no safety issue here, at least that they can prove. And so we're kind of back to at least I would like a national voluntary standard, something that I could say to our suppliers, this is what we're expecting. Because right now we don't know what to ask our suppliers. So our specifications do not ask that question yet. And it's the suppliers don't know. Do they go by the non-GMO project rules? Do they go by Vermont? What do they go by? If I was a Kellogg's or a General Mills, I've got other questions to answer, but I'm not.
Okay, so. Before I go to Anthony Shelton, I think Matt Kelly wanted to weigh back.
Yeah, I think it's saying that a national standard would circumvent labeling of GMO foods is... a national standard isn't necessarily going to prevent that from happening. It depends on what national standard you put in place. The one that was recently attempted to be passed by Congress, 2609, was a voluntary standard that would have preempted states' rights. And certainly the perception was that it was being put in place to stop Vermont from moving ahead. There's another one, 2621, that is currently in place, which very much conforms in both language and process, looks very much like what Vermont has done, what Connecticut has done, what New York wants to do, and would present mandatory labeling of GMO laws for the United States.
All right, Cornell University Professor Anthony Shelton, I don't know if you, do you come down on any side on GMO labeling laws? I mean, I know you certainly have your feelings about GMOs in general, but what about labeling laws? Does New York State need this?
Well, that's an interesting direct question. You know, you label something if there's a potential hazard to it. For example, like allergenicity or, you know, a nutrient deficiency. And in the case of the products that are out there right now, there's really no reason to label them from the safety standpoint. And I fear also that if they are labeled, a label implies something is wrong with them. And I think that's what people will believe. And consequently, if the farmers are not going to be able to produce some of these very beneficial crops that have dramatically reduced pesticide input, my fear is that the farmers will have to go back to some older technology.
So, Anthony, in other words, just the very nature of the question, should we label GMOs that are in our food? If you walked out on the street and asked 50 people, hey, do we need to start labeling zinc that's in our food? A certain number would say yes, just on the assumption that the fact that you're asking means there's something dangerous about it?
I think that's right. And many of the vitamins, for example, that go into food, those are produced through genetic engineering. And so if you don't allow those products to be in food, or if you label them and people avoid them, I think that's going to run into fairly big problems.
Okay. And Matt Kelly, I know you want to come back there. Brian on Twitter says, please ask your guests why 99% of agreement by scientists is okay on climate change but not on GMO safety. Is that fair?
Well, can we back up for a second?
Absolutely.
There's a few things. So talking about the labeling, Tony's right about a few things when it comes to labeling. Labels can be used to indicate danger or warning. A nutritional label isn't a warning. It's information. And so what we have to talk about, really, the real issue here, because he also brought up the issue of agricultural systems and production. Completely different show, completely different topic. When it comes to talking about labeling in this particular context, it really is an issue of providing customer information for consumers to make decisions. How that labeling occurs determines the way in which consumers take and use it. If we make it look like a warning label, sure, that could imply warning. If we make it an informational label, that's something different. So let's not confuse the issue of labels with implying danger. They're two separate things. Labels can do that. Labels tell you it's Christmas time, you should buy things for Christmas. And that's not a warning label. That's merely a label on products. Nutritional labels are informational and educational labels. So there's a variety of ways to label things. The question about 99% consensus from scientists. we can talk about the science in a little bit, because there are some interesting details about the science that actually exists. One thing that I felt very important to do in the story that I wrote, I don't feel that the science that has been done on GMOs as food is bad. That's an important distinction to make. However, it is limited in what it has looked at, and it is not as complete as opponents to labeling would suggest. For example, there's one study that can, and you read this in the article, there's one study that's consistently pointed out that has 1,700, it's a research review, 1,700 bits of research that say that GMO labeling is safe, or GMOs are safe to eat as food. In reality, only 312 of the studies in that review talk about actually consuming GMOs as food. 12 of those studies focus on unintended consequences, and 6 of those studies showed unintended consequences with GMO food. So there is, when we are talking about the safety issue and what the science says, there's good science out there. There's no doubt in my mind. However, it is not as complete and not as pervasive as many people would have us believe.
All right. On this, I'm going to have Tony Shelton respond to that in a second. I know, Jane, you wanted to jump in on labeling. You agree on the subject of labeling. Matt's saying, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean there's something wrong if you put
you,
it on
you, label. You raised the question of the man on the street.
Yeah.
What we've seen in the research, what I've seen in the research is it all depends on how you ask the question. So we have, I look at labeling research all the time, and if you ask people, what are you most concerned about and what would you like to see on the label, very few people mention GMOs. Other things pop up to be much more concerning, because it is. GMOs is, a lot of people, if you ask them what a GMO is, they don't even know what it is. They hear the word, they don't know what it is. So that's one thing I would say, is that when you're talking about the man on the street, you've got to, there's lots of caveats there depending on how you ask the question. The other thing I will have to mention, and you know, I've been around for quite a while and been to many meetings over the years on both sides of this issue, and I think it is fair to say that a strategy, at least the strategy 15 years ago, and I think it's continued, from the folks who are advocating non-GMO, was that let's get the labeling first, because without the labeling, we can't attack the product. And so they want the labeling as a strategy toward attacking the product. So I agree with Matt that how you do the labeling could come across differently. But I think from what I suspect many of the bigger food companies fear is that their product will become on a target list of activists about don't eat this food. And so from a public relations standpoint, I think that's also where they're coming from.
Is that fair, Matt?
I would bet that is where they're coming from, but I would also suggest that food companies are really good at marketing. If they wanted to point out how good GMOs are, they could do it. Here's an interesting story, right? So the issue of labeling is how well companies can respond to this and what they want to do with it. I am connected with a reporter down in the D.C. area through Twitter. 2 days after the Senate bill, S-2609, the one that was going to be voluntary labels, failed to pass in the Senate, or failed to move on in the Senate. She tweeted a picture, 2 days afterwards, tweeted a picture of an M&M packet that said produced with GE ingredients. And I wrote back and I was like, did you make that up? Because that's like,
no, Hershey's is not.
Yeah. This is Mars, right?
This is Mars. Okay.
So,
but Hershey's as well.
Right. Hershey's as well. But Mars did this. And I was like, did you make this up? Is this like a joke? She's like, no, I just pulled it out of the machine. According to her calculations, Mars had already had that label ready to go.
They have to, right. They have to if they want to be in Vermont.
Right, but I guess my point is this. Companies are extraordinarily good at working labels. If there was a genuine interest for companies to want to work this label the right way, that's what we could work out. It wouldn't be a resistance to labeling, period. It would be, okay, if we're going to do labeling, let's do it. Let's make it happen the right way. But that's not the conversation that has occurred. The conversation that has occurred is general public, typically 75% or more, saying we want GMs labeled. Companies haven't said, okay, let's figure out a way to do it. They've been like, no, completely unnecessary. Let's talk about all these tangential issues that have actually nothing to do with the consumer's right to know. Which is extraordinarily interesting to me that isn't the conversation that has occurred.
All right. Let me let Anthony Shelton jump back in, because there's been a lot of comments about some of the science. I suspect once we get past some of where the labeling is, and by the way, Matt, do you think this labeling law is going to pass? Matt and Jane, is this going to pass this year?
I don't make predictions like
okay.
that.
I'm trying to get your finger on the pulse of this.
It's an election year. This is a hot button issue, very difficult for politicians to put their name on. I think it's I'd be very surprised if it passed this year.
You're going to say no, Matt? You think it could?
I think there's greater potential this year than before, particularly since we're seeing what's happening at the national level with things.
Okay, so one of the reasons we're discussing this, certainly not a slam dunk either way, I think is what Matt is saying, and Jane agrees. And Anthony Shelton, when it comes to the science there, one of the subjects of Matt's four-part series, and again, if you want to read that, we'll link to it on Twitter. It's boomtowntable.com. It's a four-part series that Matt wrote on GMOs. He's saying that, yes, in one sense, there's good science out there. But in another sense, when we talk about the number of studies, that he thinks it's sort of been maybe misrepresented as overbroad, and that we need stuff that is more longitudinal and better equipped to tell us what's actually going on. Yes or no, Anthony?
Well, so I'm an entomologist, and I work with insects affecting crop plants, and I work with traditional growers, organic growers, and growers who use biotech products. And if we can get the a crop to be resistant to insect attack, then synthetic pesticides don't have to be sprayed on it. And all of the insect-protected crops out there right now are expressing, they produce a protein called BT that is perfectly safe. It was something that was endorsed by Rachel Carson back in 1962 in Silent Spring. And so these plants are just producing a protein from a bacterium, and they resist the pest attack. This same protein can be sprayed on by organic growers or conventional growers. It doesn't work so well when it's sprayed on. So I guess I would ask the question, so should you also label the crop that gets the spray of the BT? Should that be labeled? I think it's really confusing to the public when you have something like a very safe product like BT, and if you put that, have it engineered into a plant to make it resistant to pest attack, should that plant be labeled as genetically engineered, and the crop, the sweet corn crop, for example, that's sprayed with a BT, that should get no label at all? I think there are just really complicated scientific and policy issues to this question. And then if you are labeling, and this, I read through the law, and or the proposed law, and it has lots of, arbitrary and maybe even capricious kinds of things in it. For example, it excludes cheese. Well, cheese is made with an enzyme that's genetically engineered. It excludes a number of other products that are genetically engineered. So it seems to me that it's very arbitrary what you are calling a genetically engineered ingredient in a food, and in whether you have to label that.
Matt Kelly, go ahead.
Well, I think Tony raises some interesting points. I guess what I would say as an overall discussion point is I don't think anybody sees this law or labeling of bio. I mean, I certainly can't speak for the folks who have written the law, the folks engaged with the law. I am certainly not pretending to represent everybody who's either advocating for the law or opposing the law. But what I think is really interesting is that a law such as this and a label for genetically engineered ingredients is not a single final step. And that's sort of the way it gets spun when folks are speaking against labeling. I'm not suggesting that either anybody involved with this conversation is currently doing this, but in the general conversation that happens out there, it's very much presented as a one step done, and if we only do it this way, it's going to get confusing. This is a first step, and I think what it really speaks to is folks are no longer simply interested in what is in their food, but how it is produced. production of food has become just as important for consumers as ingredients in food. We want to know how it is produced so that we can make judgments based on that, not just what is in the can or in the bag or in the box.
I understand that point. Brian follows up, Matt, and he writes to us, you know, it sounds like the response from one of your panelists is a pretty classic, we need more research. When is enough enough? Anti-vaxxers still say we need more research.
Yeah, and I think that's, I mean, that's an excellent point. It's not one I'm going to argue against because you can always find chinks in the armor, right? You can always find a reason to keep going and keep going and doubt something. Let me see if I can respond to that in a reasonable way for the individual. Mm-hmm. So, when you look at the study I mentioned, which is a classic study, it's actually posted on Monsanto's website. That's actually where I got the reference from. It's one of the studies that they say shows are perfectly fine. 1,700 studies exist. Well, only 312 of them are done on consumption of food, right? So there, you know, there's a little bit of disingenuous presentation of information there. Another study that's been done has been held up as a classic example is one on animal consumption of food. And there has been no testing of GM foods on humans other than golden rice. They did do an experiment with that. Or not an experiment, but they did test to see whether that was good for people. But in the study that focused on animals, it's held up as a study that says there are 55 long-term studies reviewed in this paper. And approximately, depending on how you parse out the studies, approximately one third to one half of the studies actually call out unintended consequences on the biology.
But what does that mean?
What it means is that they showed there was differences between animals fed GM crops or GM food and non-GM equivalents. And so you would see immune changes, you'd see cellular changes, you would see all these different things. The literature review, the authors were critical of how some of those studies were done, but they were critical overall. And one of the things they pointed out is that all of these studies that they reviewed had faults in the experimental process, whether they showed they were safe or whether they were unsafe. They said that one of the biggest problems is there was no replication. A single study with a single animal type, with a single food type, looking at maybe nutritional content versus how it affects the immune system, all of these studies were different. None of these studies were replicated. So it's very hard to see scientific consensus when you have a variety of different animal types, a variety of different measures, a variety of different crops. None of them are replicated. And most importantly, there were no long-term studies done with rodents on the consumption of GM corn. Rodents are a typical animal used in the lab to assess human health hazards. None were done with corn. And so it's very hard to then go back and say, okay, we have all this evidence that shows that GM corn is safe to eat over the long term for humans.
All right, so help me understand one thing, though. Why do you think, when scientists are pulled on this, most scientists are now, Michael Pollan, food writer, the guy who wrote Omnivore's Dilemma, which was a seminal work for so many Americans when it comes to food consumption habits, food knowledge, etc., he describes himself, and the New Yorker's written about this, he's almost feeling like a lone voice raising concerns about GMOs because he says in the scientific community, it's something approaching consensus, and he's feeling a little lonely still standing out there on this. So why is it that the scientific community, if what you're presenting here, and I'm not questioning what you're presenting, but you know it better than I, Jane knows it better than I, Tony knows it better than I do, but why is the scientific community almost speaking close to monolithically now, saying, you know, GMOs not only aren't going to hurt you, but they've done a lot of good things? Are they missing what you are presenting? Why do you think that is?
I don't have a good answer for you. And that was one of the questions that really came up while I was writing this article. I mean, part of this was, who's never seen this before? Like, who's never actually looked at these studies and said, oh, look at these discrepancies that exist, or at least what appears discrepancies to me. I've run this by friends who know scientific research far better than I do in terms of how to look at and assess its validity. And they're like, those are some excellent points. I don't know why nobody's ever pointed that out before. I don't want to guess why scientists might be speaking monolithically. I guess the best I can say is scientists are human too. And we all have certain, you will look at something quickly, we'll say, yeah, I can dig the science on that. Boom, it seems reasonable to believe.
But a listener named Jake, he writes in, if your guest can provide a single shred of evidence that shows that GMOs are demonstrably harmful, I'll change my tune, but there is none right now. This is nothing but doubt and fear. It's not science. That's from Jake.
Jake, give me a second here, bud. If you want to go on with something else, Evan, I'll come right back for you.
Tony, why don't you respond on the scientific side, because you do work in the scientific community. Why do you think there is something, and again, I'm careful with the word consensus or a monolith, but there is a vast majority of scientists who are now saying GMOs are not only safe to eat, but they provide societal benefits. Tony, why do you think that is the message coming from the science community?
Well, when these questions come up, we look at the research. Every National Academy of Science organization, even the European Food Safety Authority, has said the products out there now on the market are safe. I always try and temper that remark by saying, it all depends on the product, though. The products that are out in the market now have gone through some, very rigorous scientific studies and approval, and then they get marketed. There are some other products that never get marketed because they have lacked evidence of their safety. So, it's hard making generalities by saying everything is safe, everything is unsafe. What scientists do is they just really judge the product and determine whether it is safe. The idea, in Europe is that they are judging the process. So if something is genetically engineered, for example, they say, whoa, right off the bat, we feel that it is unsafe. And I just don't think that that's a good scientific way of looking at it.
But that
in the U.S., we just look at the product and not the process, and we judge the safety of the individual product.
Tony, I'm interrupting, but
go ahead, Jake.
You just said that the Europeans look at this as the process is unsafe. But before that, you said that the European Union considered GMOs safe. So you're talking about two different European government agents. I just think you need to clarify that a little bit about who's saying what. You made two different statements there.
Thanks, Jane. So the European Food Safety Authority judges these products and the process that went into them. The General Regulatory Authority, and the perception in Europe, though, is that if something was genetically engineered, it is unsafe or right off the bat, and then you have to prove the safety. Does that clarify it, Jane?
Well, what I've understood is that there's not an organization quite comparable to FDA, that's much more, the political side of things come into play a lot more. So consumers have a much stronger voice in the decisions that are made about labeling in the UK. Whereas FDA is mandated to be science-based, they're not mandated in the same way. So it is a different standard, however you look at it.
Well, Tony, go ahead.
Also add one other fact. In the U.S., we look at risks versus benefits. In the European system, it's really just more looking at risks. And in the U.S., for example, we've had corn out there since 1996, genetically engineered corn that's, resists insect attack. And I was looking up some figures recently, and during that time, there's been a 47% reduction in the use of synthetic insecticides because of the use of these BT corn. That's really amazing and a great benefit, I think, to farm workers and to the environment. So I look at this, as an entomologist and say, okay, how do we control pest insects? If we can do it better with a crop that's expressing a bacterial protein, that is really a benefit that we have to consider as a very positive move forward.
All right, Matt Kelly, go ahead.
So some interesting points that have come up, right? And Jake, I am going to get back to you with that information. Don't think that I've forgotten you.
Okay.
So there has been a reduction in insecticide use, but an increase in herbicide use, which is an important point to make. Glyphosate is the most commonly used herbicide in the United States, mainly as a result of 90% of the 97 million acres of corn we grow in this country that is GM, that is genetically engineered to resist the herbicide. So while insecticide may have decreased, herbicide has increased and will continue to increase for a variety of reasons. The FDA system that looks at the safety of foods is really a pre-market assessment, right? They look at certain things. They look at whether or not there's nutritional equivalent between a GM variety and a similar non-GM variety. So do they have the same kind of nutritional content in them? Awesome if they do, great. They look at whether or not the proteins produced in the process of genetic engineering will result in proteins that we know are whether or not toxins or allergens. Occasionally, they will do an animal feeding study if they feel it is necessary. They do not do it all the time. And in fact, there's plenty of literature out there that says, well, we really don't want to do it because it's too costly to do it to bring stuff to market that way. So there's a business expediency to why they don't do animal testing on all the GM varieties that they want to bring to market. And also what they don't do is they don't do post-market testing. They don't look at how this plays out in the market. And according to the international standards that Monsanto and other companies propose to follow in this pre-market assessment, within those standards, if you continue reading them, they call for post-market monitoring. They put that within their standards of how to manage the whole package of including GM crops in the food system.
Who's calling you?
Who's calling you?
Sorry.
That's okay, Jane. let me do this. Let me jump
sure.
in and say, you just mentioned Monsanto.
Yeah.
A listener named Barry writes to us and says, I have unsuccessfully tried to keep up on all aspects concerning GMOs. The only thing I am now sure of, Barry writes, is if the name Monsanto is somehow mixed in with the issue, I am against it. That's what Barry said. He says otherwise he's not been able to follow. So here's what I want to do. I'm late for a break. Let me get this break
sure.
in. I want to come back. I want to take a listener phone call on that exact subject. But the last point before break I think is important because we're going to spend the rest of the hour talking about some of these, you know, what is Monsanto doing? You know, should we be concerned or not when it comes to GMOs? But Matt also wrote about, in his Boomtown Table series, Matt wrote about the cost. And Matt, real briefly here, some of the hype surrounding the cost to consumers, you analyzed and found in your piece, been overstated. That will it cost more? Potentially, yes. Is it going to be hundreds upon hundreds of dollars more on an annual basis? Probably not. Is that fair?
Yes. That is an accurate statement.
Okay. So, in other words, if food companies have to create individual labels for individual states, they don't want to do it. It's going to be a little more burdensome, more of a pain to them. They'll pass some of the cost on to consumers, but for those who've been saying, expect hundreds of dollars a year, expect these astronomical costs, your work says almost certainly not.
Well, and I think you're making a presumption in that question that they're going to produce individual labels for individual states.
Well, they would have to, wouldn't they?
No, they wouldn't have to. Mars just did it with their
M&M label. Oh, you're saying they would just do it universally?
Yeah, they do it universally.
Big deal.
I mean, here's my example. You walk into Home Depot,
that's
you pick
possible.
Up a bag of concrete, it says this has been found cancerous in California. Well, I clearly don't live in California, but they're doing it all across the board.
I got it. Okay, so you're saying that could be the new national label anyway?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's effectively, yes.
Okay, and Jane, is that what you'd expect would happen? Okay. Okay, short break, your phone calls. We'll talk more about GMOs coming up in just a second. Matt Kelly's here, writer and photographer for Boomtown Table Online. Jane Andrews, nutrition and product labeling manager for Wegmans. Anthony Shelton on the line with us, a professor of entomology and associate director of international programs for Cornell University. Short break, more connections next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections. There was very good reason to think the Syracuse Orange wouldn't be playing in the NCAA tournament this year because of violations. But when it comes to penalties, Syracuse made some decisions that turned out to be pretty savvy. It's one of the reasons they are here. Unlikely participants in the Final Four. We'll look at how it all happened Thursday on Connections.
When you fill out your 1040 income tax form, you probably gloss over a whole bunch of the lines because they don't apply to you.
We could go line by line, you know, through the front of the 1040, and you're going to see a special interest on every line.
Line 24, for instance, that's for performing artists. Learning how it got there later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let me go ahead and grab a phone call, and then we'll work through some of these related questions. And Carol in Rochester wants to weigh in there. Go ahead, Carol.
Hey, hi. I'd love to ask the entomologist a question based on some of my readings. And what I've read is that because there's the BT that is in the GMO corn, and that corn is a wind pollinator, when that pollen blows onto the milkweed, what I've read is that when the monarch butterfly larvae are eating the milkweed, that sometimes they have as much as up to a 98% kill. So I know we're talking about different animals, but I'm also wondering about how pollinators might be affected. So I'll take this offline, and thank you.
Carol, thanks for the phone call. Anthony Shelton from Cornell, go ahead.
Sure. Well, the BT that's in corn is actually, it kills caterpillars. It's meant to kill caterpillars that are infesting the corn. And it does it quite well. If there are some monarch butterflies, larvae around the corn, in theory, if there's enough BT pollen that gets on the milkweed and the monarch larvae feed on it, that could be hazardous to their health. But when the studies have actually been done, and these were published in the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences several years ago, a whole series of studies, the effect on the monarch butterfly population was considered negligible. So these were very clear scientific studies that just found that monarch butterfly populations as a whole are not really going to be impacted by BT corn. The thing that does impact monarch butterfly populations are their overwintering site down in Mexico, the logging that's occurring down there, cold weather and things like that. Those are really the main things that are causing some decline in monarch butterfly populations. But, this last year was a banner year for monarchs. So I'd say that the BT corn is just a minor element in this scenario.
Well, let me read from a couple of sources on maybe some ongoing questions about GMOs from a couple of different sources here. And so I was up very late, too late, reading too much, and my brain is overpacked. But Carol's question was sort of about environmental impact. So let me read from two different sources, and we'll let our panel respond to this. The New Yorker covered some of Michael Pollan's ongoing concerns, and Michael Pollan says the following about GMOs. He says, the technology has backfired in some instances. Many farms using Roundup Ready seeds, for example, have developed herbicide-resistant weeds, prompting farmers to use more and stronger herbicide sprays. And writing for Grist online, Nathaniel Johnson writes that for the most part, GMOs are providing a range of benefits, but he has one concern, and here's what he writes. Quote, to understand the environmental effects of GMOs, I started by looking at plants genetically modified to be insect resistant and concluded that they have, on balance, helped reduce overall insecticide use in U.S. farming. The picture isn't so rosy with the other main trait that GM agribusiness promotes, herbicide tolerance. While it's clear that genetic engineering has reduced the amount of insecticides that farmers spray, it's just as clear that it has encouraged a much larger increase in the use of the herbicide glyphosate. And while insect resistance is safeguarded by some insufficient regulations, there are no regulations to rein in the way that herbicide-tolerant plants encourage overuse of herbicides. Charles Benbrook is a research professor at Washington State University who says, from the beginning, I've always said that glyphosate is a great herbicide. It's one of the safest on the market, but there are real consequences in using so much of it. The most obvious consequence has been the spread of glyphosate-resistant weeds. End quote. Matt Kelly, what do you make of that?
Well, I think they're all valuable points to make. I mean, I think the caller's question is a really good one, and again, it highlights how important the overall production system of our food for our food plays for consumers these days. It's not about what's in the can; it's about how it gets into the can. I think the glyphosate issue is a really, really, really important one to address. And the problem, the real problem we face with that is that the FDA has never, ever, ever tested for a level of glyphosate residue in our food, despite the fact that it's the most common herbicide used in American agriculture, actually in America overall. And they just got called out by the GAO, the General Accounting Office, for actually being disingenuous about how they presented information. Whereas the FDA will say, FDA tests for residue on food. They test for common pesticides, residue of pesticides on the food. They never mentioned that they didn't test for glyphosate. And that is a huge issue.
But two things on that here. First of all, there's kind of a so what issue if they're also testing, if the test so far, if the studies have shown that GMO foods, of which glyphosate is certainly been used to help create in many ways, if studies don't show any health problem thus far, and again, maybe there's not as many longitudinal and broad studies as you want, but if sure. The studies are not showing a problem so far, why are we, you know, sort of spreading the specter that glyphosate could be at a level that could be dangerous if we don't have any evidence of that? And number two, what does, when Charles Benbrook from Washington State says the most obvious consequence is the spread of glyphosate-resistant weeds, what is that consequence? I mean, pretend I don't know anything about agriculture,
right,
which I might not.
Right.
What is the consequence?
Well, the simple answer is we just have to spray more and more. So there is going to be...
They have to go back to what they did before.
They have to go back to what they did before, which is actually what just got approved by the EPA. There is going to be now it's called Enlist Duo. So they're using not just glyphosate, but 2,4-D in combination, which is an incredibly noxious substance, to start combating these weeds. And it's this, you know, arms race of diminishing returns. The more we spray, the more resistant they get. We are speeding up the process of resistance, as opposed to achieving a balance between what happens in a natural ecosystem.
Okay.
Let me get...
Okay. I want Tony Shelton to weigh on that in a second, but go ahead. If you have a way to help articulate the concern about glyphosate, are we overhyping the risk that you think is currently out there?
Well, I think what's important, let's do this. I think we really need to reel this conversation back into the labeling issue, because what we're starting to do is expand into all these other issues around an agricultural system, which deserves at least one, two, or three more shows to talk about adequately. If we are talking about whether or not we should be labeling GM ingredients in our food, in New York State, or in the country as a whole, there's very little evidence that I have found to argue against that. To answer Jake's question, Jake, just to get back to you, look at the study by Snell et al. It's a 2011 literature review. It was of those animal feeding studies. And some of the unintended consequences that were found were irregularly shaped nuclei, higher nuclear pores, there are immune and pancreatic disorders. There's all sorts of things that you will find in the raw evidence that those authors present, and I'm sure we can put a link somewhere.
And Jake is somebody probably will dig into that. So what's the study again?
It is Snell et al. There's a whole long bunch of authors in it. It's a 2011, and I can get you the link so that people can easily look for that.
I suspect he will be following up with us after he reads that. Tony Shelton, when it comes to glyphosate-resistant weeds, should we be worried about that?
Well, there are glyphosate replaced some much more toxic herbicides, and when the glyphosate-resistant crops were deployed, starting in 1996, there have been, increases in resistance in weeds. That was not really unexpected. Unfortunately, there weren't put into place or mandated the same kind of what we call resistance management strategies for herbicides as there were for insecticides. Basically, I think probably things could have been better with the glyphosate, and that would have delayed the evolution of resistance. But there are, when weeds do get out of hand, there are other options that the growers have. As far as that question about, the safety of glyphosate, though, glyphosate is caffeine is, I think, 10 times more toxic than glyphosate. So if you're looking for, residues on the crop of glyphosate and being concerned about harm by that, those residue levels are very, very low. And when you consider that caffeine is 10 times more toxic than glyphosate, I think you really have to wonder about how the question was asked.
Okay. Matt, is that fair?
I always think it's important to consider how the question was asked. I mean, we've been talking about that all along.
Yeah.
I guess what I would caution against in these discussions, and this is something that comes up again and again and again when it comes to labeling, is that we've been eating GM foods for 20 years since they were introduced back in 1996, mm-hmm. right? Absolutely no evidence that they're harmful. Well, there's absolutely no evidence of anything, period. I mean, when you look at the pre-market assessment for GM foods is about assessing nutritional equivalence and whether or not it has an allergen or a toxin in it. It does not look at how things play out over long-term consumption. And a lot of these studies in the Snell studies looked at long-term multi-generational consumption of GM foods. I'm not suggesting that they're perfect. I'm suggesting that to say that there is no evidence at all that GM foods are completely safe is a disingenuous thing to say. Many of these studies also say we found one thing and we should continue to look into it. Nobody's ever continued to look into it. So the body of scientific evidence, if we're going to be scientific about this, we have to recognize the limitations of what exists and we have to continue to dig into that. I mean, science isn't about proving what you think. It's about trying to disprove what you think. It's about taking, okay, I have this theory and if I try to poke holes in it in all these different ways, and it doesn't fall apart, well, very likely will be true. I can say with high confidence that it's going to be true, that what I believe is true. That, according to what I have found, based on the information I have looked at, that actually hasn't happened to a high degree across the board with all the considerations. That is my concern. And I need to be very clear about this, too, is I don't think the science that has been done to this point is bad. That is not what I am saying. That is not what I'm arguing. I am saying it is limited and incomplete. And so it's a disingenuous argument to say, they're safe. We don't need to label them.
I know Jane wanted to jump in. Go ahead, Jane. And Tony wants to jump in as well.
With nutrition research, what is it in food that promotes life extension or disease is the other side of it. We do look at generation over generation. If you think about Harvard's research, longitudinal studies, the nurse's health study, the physician's health study, I've wondered and have asked researchers, why couldn't we compare disease rates and how people are eating in Europe, where there's far less GMO over the past 20 years, and in the U.S.? I asked that of Walt Willett at Harvard, and he said, we would never do such a study because there's not enough underlayment of concern. For example, we're beginning to see longitudinal studies that include the microbiome, because we know that what the gut bacteria and the changes in the gut bacteria of the human can make a difference, we think, in disease rates in children. And so we're beginning to test that. And Harvard is taking, besides all the blood measures they're doing and all the other biometrics, now they're also including the microbiome of the baby all the way through the teen and to see what happens. But he's feeling that there's not enough underlayment of concern for him to even begin to look at that research. There's not any differences shown in the foods to support anybody funding him. Very expensive research. There's no reason to fund it.
All right, Tony Shelton, go ahead.
Yeah. So in the scientific community, you know, we examine each other's papers, we criticize, we agree, and it's open for discussion. I think the study that your guest is talking about by Seneff and Samsil, you know, which was claiming glyphosate was causing all sorts of diseases from bowel disease to Parkinson to depression, that review has really been soundly criticized. And
Tony, just to be clear, that's not the study I was talking about.
Okay, well...
I was talking about a different study related to the consumption of GM food.
Okay. So what one has to be very careful about, though, is judging the quality of the studies and not just, that such and such study claimed this. And we look at the preponderance of evidence, and when we do that, we find that, you know, there's really no evidence that glyphosate is causing these... problems that you're mentioning. I would like to get back to that idea, though, about labeling, because that's what this conversation is about. And labeling you know, the proponents of labeling have been on record as saying, you know, that they want to basically get GM crops off the market, and this is the first and best state way of doing it is to just cause labeling, and that will put an image on GM crops. And so, you know, they're trying to get them off the market, and I'm not sure. There's certainly no safety evidence to indicate that the products out there right now have any concerns, any safety concerns at all. But if it is a movement to try and get these off the shelves, and I think that would be a disastrous outcome because we've seen so many benefits, like in pesticide reduction, because we have these crops available to us.
And that's the big concern about cost. When you see these cost estimates of $100 a year per family, I think it's not the cost of putting the label on the product. That doesn't cost us very much to say that. Behind the scenes, I got to do some research. So yeah, but the cost is more relative to what happens to the U.S. food supply.
Okay, and you just heard Tony kind of wrapping up saying it's not just that GMOs, he said, are generally safe. It's that they've provided a lot of benefits. 30 seconds, Matt, some final thoughts from you here. Go ahead.
Well, again, I think bottom line is all this comes down to the issue of the consumer's right to know and choose. I mean, I would be happy to see the science prove is a very strong word, but I'd be happy to see the science demonstrate that GMs are completely safe. Got no problem with that. I'd be happy to see scientific evidence saying a lot of things. But right now, what we're really talking about is the consumer's right to make decisions. And I think bottom line is if GM products were exactly the same as all the other food we eat, there wouldn't have been a regulatory process to begin with. They were regulated because they are different, and we need to keep an eye on them.
You can read Matt's entire four-part series from boomtowntable.com. We've posted a link to it. 15 seconds, James, just some final thoughts from you.
What the labeling will mean is a lot of products that say may contain. Just so consumers know, that's what Vermont allows, may contain. So are you really going to know? Yeah, you're going to have more questions.
All right, well, we'll follow this going forward. Not exactly sure where it ends up in New York State this year. Again, that bill, what's the number of the bill, Matt?
The bill is number A617, and in the Senate it is S485.
All right, thank you, Matt. Tony Shelton, thanks for taking the time from Cornell as well. Appreciate your expertise and time. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for listening today. Val Labenca, engineer, Megan Mack, producer, Marielle Brinkerhoff is our engineer. She's not the engineer, she's the intern. Yeah, I'm Evan. Have a great day.